Thanks for tuning in for the June 8th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology Family of Journals. For our What's Trending segment, you'll hear from Dr. Julie Fritz about a randomized controlled trial that evaluates whether early referral for physical therapy reduces disability at 6 months compared with usual care in primary care for patients with sciatica. In this week's feature interview, Dr. Hamru Siraj discusses the efficacy and safety of direct endovascular thrombectomy compared to bridging therapy in patients with large vessel occlusion stroke.
Hi, it's Jeff Ratliff with Neurology Podcast. Welcome to this week's What's Trending interview. This week, I'm joined by Julie Fritz, a physical therapist at the University of Utah. We'll be discussing a paper she published with her colleagues in the Annals of Internal Medicine titled Physical Therapy Referral from Primary Care for Acute Back Pain with Sciatica. Julie, thanks for joining us on the Neurology Podcast to discuss your paper.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So I want to set the stage a little bit with information from the introduction of your article. You outlined very clearly that low back pain, unsurprisingly, is a very common reason for patients to seek care from their PCP. On top of that, having sciatic pain that radiates distal to the knee is a marker for poorer outcomes. Recent guidelines mention that care should include educating patients about low back pain, avoiding bed rest or becoming too sedentary, and the use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. I was surprised to read that there does not seem to be a lot of evidence for physical therapy in this setting, and that's exactly what you set out to study with this project. So before we hear about the impact of physical therapy, I was hoping you can tell us exactly what kind of patients were studied here. What were the clinical features of the patients included?
Yeah, and you know, I think your surprise was something that we shared when we began thinking about this particular patient population. There's certainly a good bit of research on back pain in general, but this particular subgroup of patients was surprisingly not investigated very much. The study that we did looked at individuals who were 18 to 60, so we weren't looking at elderly individuals, with a relatively recent onset of symptoms of sciatica, so less than 90 days. And we also looked at individuals who were having a new consult in primary care for their condition. So we wanted to kind of look at this question of what should the advice to providers be when someone is newly consulting with this type of presentation.
And so given that, we're looking at patients, as you said, with fairly recent onset of pain with the specific finding of sciatica. And so tell us a little bit about the study you performed and what it taught us.
Yeah, we wanted to really look at different advice that's offered in guidelines based on what we knew at the time we designed the study. So there was some ambiguity about the value of a supervised exercise and education program like a physical therapist would provide. And that was the question we wanted to address. So we wanted to design very realistic, pragmatic options that could have an impact on clarifying some of the guideline recommendations about the value of this early use of physical therapy. So the two arms in our trial were to refer someone to physical therapy right away after the primary care visit. We had a relatively standard program of physical therapy that involved exercise, manual therapy, advice, education. The other treatment arm was a usual care arm. We did provide a session of education to patients to reassure them that the prognosis was favorable and they would likely see improvement, but there was no other treatment offered for the first 4 weeks for those individuals in our study.
And so I take from this that if I'm seeing someone with relatively recent back pain with sciatica, I should have a quick trigger or a low threshold to refer them for physical therapy. Is that accurate or should I pump the brakes a little bit? Meaning, are there tests I should get beforehand? Are there clinical features that should give me pause before I send someone right along to physical therapy? Should I send them right away? Do I need to wait a little bit? I know some people say let things cool off a little bit. What are the considerations I need to make before I put in that referral order?
I think there's several things that I'd say in response to that. First of all, yes, there's clinical signs and symptoms that would indicate a need for a different type of management or a need for additional testing prior to considering a rehabilitation approach. Things like rapidly progressive neurological signs or any sort of evidence of cauda equina, other sorts of red flag symptoms. We excluded those individuals from our project because they would need a different type of management. You know, I think on your question of, you know, should you have a quick trigger, I would say generally, yes, assuming those other conditions were not present. Although I would also want to say that, you know, like any most decisions in clinical medicine and with individuals with back pain, it should be a shared process between the provider and the patient in deciding whether that's the right course for a particular patient. You know, the natural history of this condition generally is fairly positive once red flags are excluded. So a watchful waiting approach is not dangerous to the patient. However, our study suggests that recovery can be accelerated somewhat with the use of physical therapy. So that really should prompt a discussion with patients and a shared decision.
And so once that decision has been made collectively with the patient, we've evaluated for or not identified any of these red flags. And so I want to make this PT referral and really make sure they have the best chance to get better. You mentioned that the interventions in this study were fairly standard. So are the interventions here going to be commonly utilized and known by our local physical therapists that our listeners are typically referring to? Or is there a particular expertise that I should be looking for when I'm making that physical therapy referral?
Physical therapy, like any aspect of medicine, probably the best thing to look for is someone who sees a volume of this type of patient and is experienced with managing people with back pain, people with sciatica. For therapists who work in this field and see that type of patient on a regular basis, our own in professional practice guidelines would recommend the types of treatments that we studied in this particular study. So while I'm certain that we could all find providers in our communities that don't provide guideline adherent care, that's also a fairly typical feature of medicine, I could say with good confidence that someone who sees a volume of patients in this category should certainly provide the type of treatments that we studied in our study.
So the study we're talking about looked at patients being referred to physical therapy from primary care offices. And our listeners that are listening to us now are largely neurologists. And as neurologists, we may see acute back pain, sure, but we also may be seeing more chronic back pain, or perhaps we're more likely to see patients with neurologic deficits that are attributed to lumbar spine disease. I want to pick your brain as an expert here. We're going a little bit away from the study itself, but what strategies would you suggest for how neurologists can best utilize their physical therapy colleagues when they've been referred patients that are proving more difficult by their primary care physicians?
For individuals who present like the type of patients we were studying in this project, the provider who is seeing that patient, managing that patient early on, I don't think the advice that or the results that the study that our study would suggest would differ whether we're talking about a general practitioner or neurologist or other kind of provider where that patient is seeking care. But I understand your question that the typical patient population, if there is such a thing, that would be seen in a neurology practice may look a little bit different than the type of person we were studying here. And there's a couple of things I could add maybe to expand a little bit, as you suggest, which one is there's more studies that have been done on individuals with more chronic symptoms. And we all know that those particular individuals are difficult to manage, but there is evidence to support that the type of interventions, manual therapy, exercise, education, advice, positive reinforcement, is beneficial to those patients as well. And I can also appreciate, as you mentioned, that the likelihood of a patient having additional neurologic compromise, requiring imaging, additional diagnostics to make sure that it's a person appropriate for a rehabilitation approach, that person might be a little bit more prevalent in a specialty office like neurology versus a general practice clinic.
That was great. That was really helpful. So I've been talking with Dr. Julie Fritz, a physical therapist from the University of Utah, about the role of physical therapy in acute back pain with sciatica. Her study is published in the January 2021 issue of the Annals of Internal Medicine. There's a lot more detail in the article, so I hope you all who are listening get a chance to go read it. And thanks again for listening to the Neurology Podcast.
this is Andy Sutherland from the University of Virginia. And for this week's Neurology Podcast, I have the great pleasure of speaking with my colleague, Amru Siraj from the University of Texas at Houston. Amru and I are going to be discussing a paper published in this week's issue of Neurology titled Clinical and Neuroimaging Outcomes of Direct Thrombectomy versus Bridging Therapy in Large Vessel Occlusion, Analysis of the SELECT Cohort Study. In this paper, Dr. Siraj and colleagues report data from a prospective multicenter cohort of patients with anterior circulation large vessel occlusions, or LVO, that we'll abbreviate for in this podcast, who presented to endovascular therapy capable centers within 4.5 hours from last known well. They analyzed outcomes associated with clinical characteristics and the initial imaging selection criteria for these patients and stratified the analysis by those who received IV tPA plus endovascular therapy versus those who went directly to endovascular therapy. So with that introduction, Amru, thanks for joining us for the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Andy. A pleasure to be with you and the Neurology podcast listeners.
Well, just to kind of get us started, I want to reference the fact that there have been several prospective clinical trials published this past year looking at this really important question in our field, in the field of stroke, that compared outcomes of large vessel occlusion stroke patients who were treated with the combination of tPA followed by endovascular therapy, or what you and your authors describe as bridging therapy versus endovascular therapy alone. But despite these multiple clinical trials, the results have really been mixed, and it seems there's still equipoise out there about which is the best approach for this patient population. So with this cohort study you all did for the paper, what was the major finding that you arrived upon?
Thank you, Andy. As you mentioned, a very important question on whether we should give tPA prior to thrombectomy or go directly to thrombectomy. So in this pre-specified analysis from the SELECT cohort study, we looked at the patients who received endovascular thrombectomy and, as you mentioned, stratified them into those who went directly to the angiosuite and those who received tPA, whether at the transferring hospital or the thrombectomy hospital. And we actually did find that giving IV thrombolysis prior to thrombectomy improved the overall clinical outcomes and around two times increased the chances or the odds of getting better outcomes. And the other main question is that would giving tPA be associated with delayed endovascular thrombectomy? And we did not find that to be the case. Actually, there was no delay in patient presenting directly to the thrombectomy hospital and getting their groin puncture in time. The other major question with giving IV tPA or thrombolysis in general prior to thrombectomy is the safety. Would that be safe? Or would it increase the symptomatic hemorrhage? Would it increase the mortality? And indeed, we found that it didn't cause safety concerns. It's rather decreased the mortality. So IV tPA improved the functional independence prior to thrombectomy, improved the overall functional outcomes across all the modified Rankin scales and lower the mortality, and all of those were statistically significant.
Okay, so that's an important result from this analysis, and it really validates what we have been doing and continue to do, it seems, in the large majority of stroke centers, that IV tPA prior to, or IV thrombolysis, we should say, prior to thrombectomy seems to have value, particularly in these data that you present. But maybe we could take a step back for the listeners and maybe reference some of these prior clinical trials that I mentioned earlier, Amru. So how do you think that your data contradicts or complements these prior clinical trials? What were the differences in the patient populations or the methods of treatment that may have resulted in these sort of mixed results?
Thank you, Andy. That's actually a great question and every single day a practical question. You know, the question a few years ago, as you and our listeners know, was should we do thrombectomy after giving thrombolysis? Was there any benefit from doing that? And now the question is reversed. You know, thrombectomy improve outcomes in patients with large vessel occlusion in the anterior circulation. So should we bother about giving tPA prior to thrombectomy? Does that cause delay, as I mentioned? Does that cause safety concerns? Or should we go directly to the angiosuite? And there have been multiple randomized trials, four of them published, I should say, announced so far. One of them still not published in direct in Mr. Clean No IV, that looked at this specific question. And these trials, direct MT, DEVT, SCIB, and Clean No IV, all of them did not show superiority of IV thrombolysis prior to thrombectomy. But that's not the question that they looked at, and that's a main difference between us and them. They looked at going directly to thrombectomy before without giving TPA be non-inferior to giving TPA than doing thrombectomy. So the design by itself is different. And two things, one thing not inferior to the other doesn't mean that they are equal. The other major difference is these trials largely enrolled patients who presented directly to the thrombectomy centers. While in our study, we have one-third of the patients, 76 out of 226 patients, 33%, presented to the outside hospital, received IV thrombolysis, then got transferred for thrombectomy. Major difference in the population. And how does that affect the results? Well, when you're given TPA or thrombolysis at the outside hospital, then being transferred, there is enough time for thrombolysis to be completed and for TPA to probably deliver its benefit. Our analysis, our cohort, reflect the real-life practice. The real-life practice is patients, some of them will go directly to the thrombectomy center, some of them will go to the outside hospital and being transferred. The drip and ship model continue to be the model that is that dominates.
Well, that's very clarifying, Amaru, so thank you for delving into that. The SCIP trial, for instance, whose median TPA to groin puncture time for thrombectomy was 8 minutes. So in that situation, there really is a negligible benefit of TPA that you get in hope to receive because there's no way that you could finish the full infusion of TPA prior to getting to thrombectomy. And if you ultimately get to a successful thrombectomy in that instance, then there probably isn't a measurable treatment effect of thrombolysis in that scenario, but as generalizable as it should be to most people practicing out in the community, particularly situations where the majority of situations in rural suburban areas where we're doing more drip and ship thrombolysis to thrombectomy. And I guess probably the other thing for us to point out to our listener is that if people are thinking of transitioning to tenecteplase or TNK as a preferred thrombolytic, that's another question that'll likely, you know, be employed in these future studies. It's a one-time IV bolus, and so the need for the additional infusion is not there. So that may factor in as well. And the other thing, Amaru, you mentioned some of the other characteristics as an imaging selection cohort of patients that may have modified the outcomes here. Can you just comment on a couple of them briefly, perhaps the imaging criteria or the stroke severity, and as that relates to this sort of question of bridging therapy versus straight to endovascular therapy?
Absolutely. This is vital because, I mean, this is not just from an analysis standpoint. This is when we meet our patients in the emergency room. This is how we make the decision, right? How big is their stroke? How severe is their stroke? And to triage what we do. And that's what we did in this analysis. We believe that any treatment effect, while we would like for it to be generalizable to all of the subpopulations, usually is driven from certain subpopulations. And this was our hypothesis. We looked at the stroke severity, and we looked at a stroke scale of 15. And one may ask, why a stroke scale of 15? We wanted to stratify patients between mild and moderate to severe strokes. And 15, I believe, is a good number to stratify in this direction. And in the other, statistically, it was close to the median, but it was really both clinically and statistically. And indeed, we found that patients with a stroke scale of less than 15 had significant treatment benefit or adjunctive benefit, I should say, from IV thrombolysis bridging therapy prior to thrombectomy. 83% of these patients did well as compared to 50% of the patients who received thrombectomy alone, which is close to the overall thrombectomy good outcome rate. While when you go 15 and more, this difference shrinks significantly to 41% versus 38%, which is not statistically significant. See the contrast, 83 versus 50% as compared to 41 versus 38%. And this was sustained because one may say, well, what if I wanted to triage on a stroke scale of 17. I believe 17 is where moderate stops and severe starts. We found consistent results. Of course, as you go higher on the stroke scale, your treatment effect will be not as stronger, but we found similar results with a stroke scale 17, as the listeners will read in the paper. And, you know, this was an imaging selection study, and we had all of the perfusion imaging on every single patient and other imaging. And we looked at the core size. And this is another element that we make in our taking our decision. How big is the stroke? Even if you're not looking at perfusion, you're looking at CT, how big is the hypodensity? Should I give tPA here? Is the patient eligible for thrombectomy? So we thought this is an important element. And we hypothesized that the smaller the stroke is, the more likely it will benefit from IV thrombolysis prior to thrombectomy. And this was the case. 62% of the patient did well in the bridging therapy group as compared to 46% in the thrombectomy only, direct thrombectomy group with for an ischemic core less than 50 cc on CT perfusion as compared to 50 cc or more, pretty much the same result, 26% versus 25% in the bridging therapy versus the direct thrombectomy group. And the third subgroup, and it was actually looking further into the treatment effect overall, if it was attenuated or increased based on transfer versus patients presented directly, the treatment effect or the potential treatment effect in with IV thrombolysis prior to thrombectomy and bridging therapy was larger in patients who were transferred, what we mentioned before, enough time for thrombolysis to work and to be delivered, which is good news that we continue to maintain the driven and ship model till thrombectomy is more widely available. As compared to those who presented directly, there was still treatment benefit in those who presented directly, but it was not as large as those who were transferred. So these were the three major subgroups: the stroke severity, the core size on CT perfusion, and the presentation status, transfer versus direct.
So Amaru, hearing all those results, it seems that, you know, the book's probably not closed on this question, that these are helpful. This moves the question forward in many ways, but that, as you mentioned in your conclusion, these data may inform future prospective clinical trials. So how best should our listeners take away this information and operationalize these results going forward for our LVO stroke population? Where do you see the next necessary steps here?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we believe in evidence, and you have to have randomized evidence to inform your algorithms with absolute certainty. But meanwhile, we mentioned major differences between this analysis and the prior trials, and this analysis mimicking real world practice with the driven and SHIP. So people, while they have to use their judgment in making the treatment decision, they may use this into their treatment algorithms, especially in terms of systems of care and triaging in the field, and patients with more severe strokes going to the thrombectomy hospital versus patients with less severe stroke probably going to the closest hospital that delivers tPA, which is the case currently with the drip and SHIP model.
Well, I think it can be summed up by saying the brain really doesn't care how it's reperfused in the setting of a large vessel occlusion stroke, as long as it happens as quickly and safely as possible. So,
absolutely, and I would say, you know, the take home message is: do not withhold IV tPA unless you have a contraindication. As you mentioned, Andy, the brain wants to be reperfused as soon as possible. Hopefully, this does not delay thrombectomy. We did not find it delays thrombectomy. So, in the absence of data that says IV thrombolysis result in delays that worsen the patient outcomes, we should not hold IV thrombolysis.
Amen to that. So I think that wraps up nicely. And Ruth, thank you again for your work and this paper. I've been, again, this is Sandy Sellin. I've been speaking with Dr. Amaru Siraj. I encourage all of our listeners to seek out he and his author's full paper published in the Journal of Neurology, Clinical and Neuroimaging Outcomes of Direct Thrombectomy versus Bridging Therapy in Large Vessel Occlusion, Analysis of the SELECT Cohort Study. So, Amaru, thanks again, and good luck with your ongoing work and practice.
Thank you, Andy. Pleasure to be with you and our neurology podcast listeners.
This is Jose Merino. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. Simply find the Neurology Podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, and all are available online. It's free for AAN members. Be sure to check out this week's journal, which features an article investigating whether cardiac MIBG scintigraphy can differentiate mild cognitive impairment with Lewy bodies from MCI due to Alzheimer's disease, as well as a study exploring potential factors associated with age of onset in polyglutamine disease. Please take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.